What's apparent is that, outside spending has increased in recent years.
Outside spending in the Alaska Senate race approaches $14 million. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 12th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the incredible history of the Cold War nuclear missile sites in Alaska.
There were missiles here on their cradles. They all came crashing to the ground, and the missiles split.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
The U.S. Senate on Thursday blocked a constitutional amendment aimed at reversing Citizens United. That's the Supreme Court decision allowing corporations, unions, and associations to spend unlimited amounts of money on elections as long as those so-called outside groups don't coordinate with campaigns. Senator Mark Begich voted for the amendment, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, so far the outside spending has tilted heavily in his favor.
If you watch TV, you've seen the ads.
American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Put Alaska First Pack is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Call Senator Begich. Tell him no more broken promises.
Mr. Sullivan, maybe if you're actually from Alaska, you'd know better.
By the end of last month, some 35,000 political ads had aired in Alaska for or against Senator Mark Begich and challenger Dan Sullivan at a cost of about $4 million. More than half of those TV spots were bought by outside groups, according to an analysis by the Wesleyan Media Project, and those ads are about evenly split between the two candidates. But the spending on airtime tells only part of the story. Outside money in the Alaska race is approaching $14 million, according to filings at the Federal Elections Commission, and that money is running nearly 2-to-1 for Begich. One of the biggest spenders, for example, is a national group called League of Conservation Voters, which has spent more than $1 million to help Begich, and none of it has gone to airtime.
No, we're really focused on the grassroots and connecting with Alaskans. That's our primary strategy, and that's what we'll be doing through Election Day.
That's Andy Motoro. He's treasurer of a group called Alaska Salmon Pack that's doing field work with that $1 million from League of Conservation Voters. Salmon Pack has 30 staffers and is going door-to-door in the Anchorage Bowl supporting Begich. Other outside groups on both sides of the race are spending millions more for things like phone banks, polling, and online ads. It may be running in his favor, but Begich says outside money is corrosive and drowns out citizen participation, so he wants it gone.
Well, because I've always disagreed with what the Supreme Court did on Citizens United, even before I was in the race as we're in today. I think the Citizens United that defines corporations as people is the most ridiculous court ruling I've ever seen.
One of the principles of that case is that corporations have rights under the First Amendment, as people do, to make their voices heard in elections. Begich voted this week for a constitutional amendment allowing Congress and the states to restrict corporate spending in elections. The amendment failed on a procedural vote. Begich says if he's reelected, he'll continue to press for campaign finance reform. Mike Anderson, a spokesman for Republican Senate candidate Dan Sullivan, says Begich could have kept outside money out of this race, but he refused Sullivan's offer in June of a mutual pledge to pay a penalty for every outside ad that runs for their benefit.
Mark Begich can still sign it. All it takes is his signature, and it would take these third party unlimited outside group spending off the airwaves and allow, the candidates to speak directly to Alaskans, because I think that's what they want.
Anderson didn't specify how Sullivan would vote on a constitutional amendment to undo Citizens United, but the spokesman said Sullivan would be skeptical of it.
What's apparent is that outside spending has increased in recent years, and despite Senator Begich's assertions, Congress isn't in a position to decrease this influence.
The Begich campaign dismissed the pledge as a gimmick. Begich says he wants a systemic solution for all races. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Attorneys have responded to the state of Alaska's proposed plan to address a state Supreme Court order to improve translation of voting materials into native languages before the November 4th election. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
In a 30-page document, attorneys with the Native American Rights Fund representing Yupik and Gwich'in Alaska Native voters asked for five main changes before Election Day. NARF attorney Natalie Landreth says the most important request is that the state have bilingual help for Native language voters in every community where it's needed.
You have to have a bilingual person in place in each village in advance of the election and on Election Day. That's number one. Number two, you have to have written translations in Yupik of the ballot measures, the pro and con statements, the neutral summaries, and then complicated pre-election information like what early voting is, how to get registered.
The state has now offered the changes after a decision by a federal judge, Sharon Gleason, that the voter information brochures were inadequate under the Voting Rights Act. The state's proposal does not call for one bilingual person to be in each community where voters need help. The state does address additional written translations in their proposed plan. In the plaintiff's response brief filed Wednesday, Landreth says the state must address dialect differences and get the word out about services.
Sometimes there can be one concept that has two different words in different parts of the Delta. We need to ensure that all those written materials are reviewed and adjusted for dialectical differences if there are any. Four, we're asking for posters. People need to know that this information is available. Before Election Day, they need to be told that all this information is available and given the name of a person and a place where they can go get this information.
The state addresses dialects in their proposal, but suggests they would only confer with the plaintiff communities of Togiak and Hooper Bay. It's estimated that there are between 8 and 10,000 limited English proficient Yupik language voters and somewhere between 500 and 1,000 Gwich'in language voters in southwest and interior Alaska. Judge Gleason is expected to issue an order telling the state what they need to do soon. She has not yet ruled on whether the state intentionally violated voters' rights on the basis of race and color. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A week after firing the Alaska National Guard's Adjutant General, Governor Sean Parnell is accepting applications for that leadership post. Parnell requested the resignation of Major General Thomas Katkus after a federal investigation concluded the Guard mishandled reports of sexual assault and found cases of fraud and ethical misconduct. Parnell says replacing the Adjutant General is a step toward changing the climate of mistrust that now exists.
One of the biggest things, the most significant things I can do in addressing that report is getting an Adjutant General that is able to restore that trust and confidence in leadership.
Applications will be vetted by a four-person team that includes two members of the governor's office, Labor Commissioner Diane Bloomer, and Arizona Adjutant General Michael McGuire. Parnell says McGuire was chosen for the panel because of his experience addressing similar problems in the Arizona National Guard. Parnell says he would like to have the position filled as soon as possible, but that the vetting process could take several months. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Homer company gives coffee houses a local choice for recyclable cups.
The whole idea about paying a little bit more upfront is the cost to the next seven generations is less.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Public employees, Local 71, asks you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Public employees, Local 71, working hard for Alaska. Alaska laborers and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities also know the importance of safe driving in construction zones. This message sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
The official search has been suspended for a missing kayaker on the Kenai Peninsula, pending new information. 38-year-old Leif Osmar was reported missing near the Kasiloff River by his family on Wednesday. He is the son of Dean Osmar, winner of the 1984 Iditarod. According to the Coast Guard, there was an extensive search and rescue effort on Wednesday and Thursday. Osmar's kayak was found capsized in Cook Inlet near Clam Gulch on Wednesday. According to Troopers, no signs of Osmar have been found since then. Alaska State Troopers are having difficulty recruiting local people to become troopers. Of those that do apply, 76% are from the lower 48. However, the troopers are dedicated to raising numbers and recruiting from within. KDLG's Thea Card has the story.
Recruiting troopers for AST in urban areas is difficult, but getting recruits for rural areas is even more difficult. There was a spike in recruitment when the National Geographic Channel's Alaska State Troopers TV show first aired. However, AST recruiter Sergeant Luis Nieves says the majority of those recruits were still from the lower 48. Nieves is from outside the state himself. He's from Queens, New York, but he came up in 2004 with the U.S. Coast Guard. He later joined the Alaska State Troopers and served in the Kotzebue region. Nieves says there are unfair rumors about the program.
You know, people assume that as soon as they become an Alaska State Trooper, we send them out to a bush community where they live out of a hut and are issued a honey bucket. And, I mean, that's so far from the truth.
Nieves says he sees several reasons for low recruit numbers. Although those rumors are definitely a factor, he says the real problem is generational.
We have newer generations that aren't really interested in law enforcement careers, let alone other long-term careers. And it's our obligation to try to get people, especially Alaskans, specifically Alaskans, to become interested in being law enforcement officers again.
Being physically fit is incredibly important as a trooper. Nieves says 80% of those who apply to AST fail the physical fitness requirements. However, AST does have a program to help those people reapply.
And what we've done now is we've started programs like CAMP, the Candidate Assistance Mentoring Program, where we run them through the physical fitness requirements. We let them see where they're at. And then what we do is we we'll invite local gyms to camp so that they can actually witness what the applicants have to go through for the physical fitness requirements, and then actually provide mentorship and maybe provide some feedback and training at their local gyms.
Nieves believes the biggest reason people inside the state aren't applying is because there's a misconception as to what the troopers are looking for. Nieves says AST recruiters are looking for people who have learned from their mistakes and want to help others. In Dillingham, I'm Thea Card.
Veterans from across the United States gathered in Anchorage last weekend to tour two of Alaska's eight Nike sites. The sites housed nuclear missiles in bunkers around Anchorage and Fairbanks during the Cold War. KSKA's Ann Hillman explored the military relics and their history in Alaska.
Midway up the mountain that looms over Arctic Valley, a decrepit one-room building sits in the tundra by an old gravel road. Tiles peel off the floor and broken circuitry hangs out of the wall. On a recent Saturday morning, Nike vet Greg DeRocher is giving a tour to veterans who served on the mountain and at similar sites around the state. He points out oddities, like the endless layers of paint on the wall.
And I know for a fact that some of the painting around here was done by me when I'd get extra duty for something, because I didn't always, none of us would always toe the line, you know.
DeRocher was stationed at Nike Summit above Anchorage from 1974 to 76 as a military police officer. He sat at the sentry post and tested door locks to make sure no one entered the top secret areas. He says the soldiers had many long, boring stretches, so they played quick draw with their guns or tried to slide down the mountain in the snow. DeRocher says they were there to do an important job, though he can't say much about what exactly they were doing.
I can neither confirm nor deny. I really don't know what we're cleared to say.
Other Nike vets were less reticent to talk about their time working at the sites containing nuclear missiles meant to protect the United States from a Soviet invasion. Standing on the crumbling mountaintop launch pad, a group of vets compared notes on what each person knew about the rotation schedule for the three missile launch sites stationed around Anchorage.
1 week on, 1 week standby, and then 1 week.
But the hot battery would usually have something wrong, and the standby would have to be called up, and it was just a...
Nike sites were set up near all of the major cities and military bases in the United States to protect them from Soviet airstrikes. Using radars, the soldiers tracked Soviet planes and could fire nuclear warheads at them within 15 minutes of notification. The ones in Alaska were considered especially important because Soviet planes would have to fly over the state to get to strategic sites in the lower 48. Kincaid Park was another military site. Nike site history buff Mike Cox walks through the upper parking lot and points to a gray concrete building.
You can tell this is a launch bunker. Here's the rails right here.
Cox says the sites were obsolete pretty soon after they were built in 1959. He says the radars weren't fast enough to track missiles launched from the ground or from submarines, but the military kept the sites as deterrents. One of the concrete bunkers at the park was filled with missiles during the 1964 earthquake.
There were missiles here on their cradles. They all came crashing to the ground, and the missiles split. The solid propellant was spilled all over the ground in here. Several of the missiles went live in the sense that the electronics became alive, the gyroscopes started spinning. Now just think what could have happened had that propellant gone up and exploded.
Cox says luckily nothing sparked in the area. The soldiers stationed at the site spent 3 days cleaning up the bunker. An account from one soldier calls it the most terrifying period of his life. The unit was given a meritorious citation.
However, because this was all top secret, they could never talk about it. They got a parade on base, but they couldn't tell their spouses about what they had done.
Many of the vets said that despite the high levels of secrecy, the relationships they formed as they hid from nasty weather in rec rooms and past the long, dark hours were incredibly important. For Tony Barbie, his most important relationship was with his sentry dog, a German shepherd named Monty.
Sweetest creature you'd ever want to know, unless you annoyed him or broke a rule on the entrance.
Barbie says he was bonded with his dog, who saw everyone else as an enemy. They patrolled the site at Arctic Valley day and night and in all weather conditions. He says after 2 years, in 1966, he trained the next handler, then had to leave Monty behind.
Just broke my heart. But, you know, I knew that was going to come. But I just enjoy and cherish the memories of the activities that went on and what we did. And the fact that we were a part of a force that was necessary and needed.
In 1979, the Nike Site Summit in Arctic Valley was one of the last sites to be closed in the nation. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Monica Goki. This week on AK, going green. In business, the general rule is to cut costs and raise revenue wherever possible. A company in Homer partially ignores this tenet to provide compostable and recyclable products to environmentally conscious businesses. For Loopy Lupin and its customers, the trade-off is a fair one in favor of a smaller carbon footprint. KBBI's Quentin Chandler reports.
The Two Sisters Bakery in Old Town Homer is just one of the businesses that incorporate Loopy Lupin's line of recycled and compostable goods, and the restaurant's customers love it.
When I go to a coffee shop, I love seeing
locally made and compostable stuff. And if I'm not bringing my own cup, I like to go to a place that does that.
It's fascinating to me that you can actually recycle corn and put it in a fork, make it a fork. I didn't know you could make vegetables utensils, but I think when businesses do that, that's super cool.
The obscure little company behind those compostable utensils also provides cups made with a corn-based coating, takeout containers with sugarcane fibers, compostable paper towels, napkins, and even a line of janitorial supplies.
We've sent coffee cups up to Nome, and we have a customer up in Fairbanks, and we have several customers in Anchorage. But the bulk of our sales are down here on the peninsula.
Dale Banks is Loopy Lupin's owner. We met inside one of his two warehouses. The wood-sided building is on the outskirts of town, tucked away inside a grove of trees and partially hidden by a little spillover from a neighboring salvage yard. Leaning up against the building is a makeshift sign that spells out the company name using sections of a dark green rain gutter and an aluminum dryer vent. It's a quirky place with an atmosphere to match its name. A porthole in one of the walls offers a peek at its hay insulation.
We used wood floor because we like walking on it better than concrete. And we also have solar heating walls on the south side. So when the sun shines on the wall, it actually pumps in warm air into the building.
Banks started the company in the late 90s. His signature product is the one thing Loopy Lupin makes in-house, a compostable paper coffee cup.
We start out with big cut sheets of paper, just 3 feet by 2 feet sheets of paper, and we stack them up on here. I have magnetic printing plates that go onto this printing drum, and it's a one color printer. And so the sheets are fed through there and we can print 12.
Banks demonstrates how customer logos are fixed on the plain white stock paper before it is fed into the machine.
Sort of a Rube Goldberg type machine, got the side of the cup getting fed into the machine and welded on the side and heated up on the bottom, get bottoms pushed into them.
There are a lot of steps. Michael McGuire, owner of the organic coffee shop, K-Bay Cafe, has bought the cups and several other products from Banks for years. He says buying from Loopy Lupin just makes sense for his business.
All of Loopy Lupin's products are extremely great products, and the coffee that we offer is 100% organic, so we're also kind of tying into our own belief system.
But there's a small downside. Going green means you have to pay the price. Banks says his products generally cost a little more for both him and his customers.
A lot of these things are made in smaller quantities, so economies of scale make them cost more.
K-Bay owner McGuire agrees.
It costs a little bit more up front, but the whole idea about paying a little bit more up front is the cost to the next seven generations is less.
Banks argues if more companies produce products like his, the economies of scale would balance out, and in some cases, the green products would actually cost less to make.
Processing a recycled material, for example, uses less water and energy than processing a raw material.
So if it could cost less and mean less waste produced, why aren't more companies on the same track as Loopy Lupin?
Well, that's a really good question. There's a lot of entrenched businesses that have a vested interest in continuing with the status quo. On the consumer end, people don't like to change that much.
Banks may be right. Even the customers at the Two Sisters, who claim they support greener products, say that's no reason to boycott anyone.
If they got good food and they do that, that's cool. If they don't and they got good food, usually the food is going to direct my participation.
Banks doesn't hide his frustration, but he still has hopes one day more manufacturers will put their money into cleaner raw materials. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Caltag on the Yukon River.
My name is Justin Smolka. I'm the village of Caltag. I'm the first chief of our tribe. Our village is a very beautiful place, very pleasant place to live. You could go out. Right now I live back town. But if I look back to the north and the west, the beautiful Nalato Hills, it's only a couple miles away.
And about a half a mile from me, if I drive out of town, I get to see the beautiful, mighty Yukon. We've got 180 people here. The kids have a lot of fun. They run freely. They drive freely. They're always busy playing games, running around. Most everybody's hunting, trying to get their moose. They're done with the fall chum fishing. That was the only fishing we had for the summer. We didn't catch any king salmon, what we know as king salmon, but in the Western world, they call it Chinook. That was a big disaster for us and a shock because we never, my whole life, I've never went through that, not having king salmon for, put away for our use. Our native name is Gastaw, which Gast means king salmon in Koyukon Athabaskan. Like I say, it's a very lovely place. We have peaceful town. You know, we have our little incidents here and there, but work hard to keep it a very authentic place for people to come to. The sound of the quietness, the birds, the wind, that's what I love, me, myself.
Justin Asmolka is the first chief of the Kaltag tribe. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Quentin Chandler, Lori Townsend, Ashley Snyder, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Monica Gokey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Thea Card in Dillingham, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez also reported from Anchorage, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.